Hi everyone, welcome to Psych Talks. Today we have 5 Enneagram 1s of different MBTI types. And we're gonna see what are the commonalities and what are the differences today in a free form chat. I thought it would be kind of funny to have Enneagram 1s that are known as a structured, principle, and rigid type to have a very spontaneous and fun-loving chat to reach into their arrows to 7. I'm just joking. But really, I thought a freeform chat might give you an organic look into the type dynamics. And so I'll have everyone introduce themselves. Samuel, can you tell us a bit about you?
Hi there. I'm Samuel, as usual. ISTJ, Wing 9. I'm from Brazil. I think that's it. That's what matters.
Short, concise, and sweet. TE, finding the bottom line. Done, done. And Jonathan?
I'm Jonathan. I'm in Scotland. I'm an INFJ. I've been in Joyce's channel a few times. Help bring all this together because we're working on some Enneagram 1 stuff. Nice to be back. Look forward to this conversation.
Jonathan and I were writing a book on all the 9 Enneagram types. This Enneagram 1 panel was inspired by the book that we're writing right now. And so all the panelists here have been interviewed by us both and their stories or their quotes from their life and how it symbolizes Enneagram 1 is going to be in our upcoming book. So this is a little bit of a shout out to this upcoming line of Enneagram with Jonathan and I.
A lot of a shout out to both of us and our genius.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Chuck?
Chuck Pratt. I live on Camino Island, Washington, about an hour north of Seattle. I am a self-employed shop of one, been independent as a consultant and coach and trainer for 20 years. Before that, I spent 23 years active service in the United States Coast Guard. I like helping people grow and develop.
Chuck has proactively worked against being in the pattern of Enneagram 1. So it's like you are one, but you've tried to overcome those patternings. So in a way, you've transcended a lot of the typical behaviors of one that you used to have when you were younger. And so
either I have or I'm imagining it.
Exactly. And he has this wonderful word that he uses, and it's emotional wake. With every action we do, we leave an emotional wake, a ripple effect. It was his ENTJ realization. And so I just wanted to add that because it's a beautiful word. It's a way to make you conscientious of your impact on other people. So, all right. And Amy?
Hi, I'm Amy. I live in the Phoenix area. I am a firstborn daughter to divorced parents. And I have 4 kids myself, and I am co-writing the ESTJ book with Joyce and another ESTJ.
Yeah, and they are so different because one of the ESTJs is an Enneagram 3, and Amy is an Enneagram 1. That really changes things. And Diane?
Hi, I'm Diane, ENFJ 1 Wing 2. I like to call myself a recovering type 1. I think that once you recognize your patterns, and I love Enneagram as well as Myers-Briggs typing systems, because once you can recognize your patterns, they don't have power over you anymore. They're always there. You're always going to be at their whim, but you get a little bit more control. And so I love being able to see the patterns better so that I can choose to lean in or not. I think that it's an awakening process. So I like to call myself a recovering type 1.
Beautiful. Yeah. They say that your Enneagram type is who you are not. And so in a way you learn about this personality type you have, and then you learn what's covering it. What's underneath it is actually your essence. And so you're returning back to your essence by realizing these coping mechanisms we have. All right, cool. And so, hi, my name is Joyce. I'm a certified MBTI master practitioner, and I facilitate the instrument in organizations. I also coach people, and I help people on the discovery process of figuring out their best fit type. All right, all right, all right. And so, what is something Enneagram 1-like that you did this week, just to get the conversation rolling?
Well, yesterday was the 4th weekend in a row that I smoked ribs on my pellet grill. And I've decided that I want to perfect the smoking of ribs. And so I'm going to keep cooking them every weekend until I get it to where I would like it to be. And I'm playing off of the Myers-Briggs, where it's easiest to develop your fourth function in recreation and play. I let my perfectionism go free rein when it comes to cooking. But I try to keep it out of other places.
Yeah, that's interesting. You can actually take out your Enneagram 1 on this area of life that you consciously create and then try to put it in those specific areas that you channel your energy into. It's like, I know I like to perfect things, but maybe I'll just do it on this as opposed to other people. Interesting strategy.
Now that's hilarious, because my story is I was helping my daughter with her math homework and she asked me, "Mom, why are you always so much more strict about us when we're doing our math homework and getting it right?" Now, I have a degree in math education and I've been a math teacher. So I said, "Well, because I do math and you have to do math perfectly." And so that like one TE standards, all that just comes to a massive four when she's the forefront of things, when she's looking at me and going, "Hey, I'm estimating here. I'm supposed to divide 10,000 by four and I don't know how." And I'm looking at her going, "So 100 divided by four equals," and I know she knows what quarters are. Like, she's in fourth grade. She knows what quarters are, but like, she's decided she's like regular division and not estimating for some reason. And so we're working through this, but I'm like, no, you have to remember this. And a lot of that's coming from this place of being a one and combined with being an ESTJ. And it's like, no, you can't forget, that this is the case. This is not nearly as hard as you're making it to be. No, you really have to remember.
Interesting. Yeah. When you catch an Enneagram one in their area of expertise, they know what a good standard is there, or they know what the appropriate standard is there, especially there.
I guess I can chime in next. The one that comes up all the time for me, like every week, every day, is the dishes. This is my favorite one. There's like the right way to do to the dishes, and then there's like everyone else's way to do the dishes. And so like lots of times people want to help. They want to step in, like, "You cook the meal, let me do the dishes." And I'm like, "How about no?" Like, it's terrible. So that's the one that I would say pops up a lot. But this week in particular, my younger sister, I have a sister who's 13 years younger than me, and she had her second baby. And so I had planned to, she lives about 3 hours away from me. So I had planned to go there after work. She was being induced. It was all, she's an IJ. So it was all very planned. She was going to get induced and the whole thing. So I finished my work day, drive over, she was induced. Everything was fine. I was there with my nephew who's seven. I'm taking care of their animals. I'm taking care of all the things, And then my nephew and I went to sleep. We woke up the next morning and she had had an emergency C-section. Everything had gone crazy, but she was okay. The baby was okay. It ended up all right. But the plan had been to, for me to go back to work the following day. And so I had to balance this thing of, do I go to work and kind of leave them and my mom to sort of scramble and do whatever. And for me, like, always trying to be the best sister, it's sacrifice, it's whatever. And for me, family's always first. And so, I called work and I said, "Hey, I have a whole day full of patients, but we're going to have to reschedule them. I got to stay here. I got to see this through until she gets discharged." And so I guess that's, me stepping into that role of being kind of the perfect sister for what she needed in that moment. And, anything else personal didn't matter. I needed to be there for her and what her family needed.
The one's principles of I need to do the right thing, and also the over responsibility of the one. It's like, I have to take on this responsibility to make sure things are all right.
Well, for me, I can say that I'm finally learning how to cook. Even though like I'm 26, I'm learning only now. Well, I can say that I'm really like eager to own the craft. Like, I was always trying to like peel the garlic better, because there might be techniques that allow me like to make it faster and don't lose like the material. So I'm trying to harness the moves that I can, and I cannot avoid it. I know that sometimes it's just a waste of time, but like, if I do have the skill, like, there will be no waste of time, no waste of resources. So for a long time, I can only see the benefits of it.
Well, this particular week I've been off work and I've been a little bit sick, so try to think of an the only example I can give is actually a negative example. I have been procrastinating a lot on a particular project that I'm supposed to be doing, also with Joyce. Basically, there's a lot of writing I was hoping to get done this week, and instead I just found myself like constantly thinking about it and researching it and preparing for it in my mind, but not being able to actually get it done. So I hope Joyce isn't expecting too much in the near future, but it will be, when it is done, it will be fantastic. But that's a lifelong problem I've had, where like I think I'm a pretty good writer, but I struggle to actually sit down and write things out, except at like the absolute last moment historically, because in my mind I'm always preparing what I'm going to write, what I'm going to say, and there seems to be some kind of gap, some kind of like jump I have to make between thinking and doing, which is a slight problem. So I'm a little ashamed of myself this week because I really hope I'm getting more done than I did. But that's my example of my one-ishness this week.
Yeah, so it's almost like your perfectionism stops you from doing the thing. Yeah, got it.
I resonate with that a ton, Jonathan. As Joyce and I are working on our project together too, there's sort of that perfectionism is sort of just silently kind of eating away at the confidence, if you will. Like I struggle too to kind of sit down and actually do the work. I struggle to feel like I have enough expertise, or you know, what I want to put on paper is going to be good enough. And so it is kind of hard to write in between. And Joyce, you're always so good about, we're making a date, we're going to write together. And that makes me kind of put it to paper. So it helps me get into action. And yeah, I resonate with that a lot, Jonathan.
Yeah. And coincidentally, I'm co-authoring a lot of books with some of the panelists here. So people are like, what is Joyce doing?
What is Joyce not doing? I think that's the question. How do you think Amy compares to the type 3 ESTJ? What are the similarities and differences?
Wendy, who is the Enneagram 3 ESTJ, she keeps talking about TE users. They want to look good in front of the eyes of other people, like very image conscious. They need recognition, achievements, and to work hard all the time to be succeeding, successful. There's this huge element of image management that Wendy has, and also the need for success and the need for this trophy, like external measures of success that Amy doesn't have as much of. Wendy is the work hard, play hard ESTJ, and then Amy is the work hard and then relax.
Yeah, be lazy, relax. Just like, you know, when I'm in relaxed mode, I don't strike people as ESTJ, and then I kind of like freak them out when I go into work mode. But that's also my compensating mode of like, if everything's going on is too much, I simply back out and I do nothing, where Wendy doubles down on doing more with things. And I don't do that because, that's my, I think almost the 9 side of being a 1 sometimes, you know, as far as that goes, I do things because it's the right thing, not because how people see me. Like, I want people to know where my values are. And I like that part of my image process. I want that to be very clear, but I'm not going to change what I do because people don't appreciate the persona I put forward or the values I stand for. That does not matter to me. I'm going to continue doing the things I believe is right, just simply because I believe they're right. And I prefer people to understand who I am. That makes life easier if they do. But I'm not going to change things just because other people were looking at me and not approving or not giving me success over doing things. Where I think Wendy is much more influenced by those kind of things as opposed to me.
Yeah, and I think another difference is Wendy, when one of her image related things is gone, when the career or the role or the thing that gives you status is taken away, it's like, who am I now? There's this huge void. Whereas for Amy, there's less of that void when that image or role is taken away from you. It's still there, but maybe it's a little different.
I think part of it is I am connected to more things than she is. So if you take away one of them, I'm not as much fazed by that, because I know that the waves come and the waves go and I'll be fine. And I'm pretty serene about that in the face of troubles, where for her, it's very much emotional high and low over those kind of things, where to me, if I'm doing really well, that doesn't mean I'm necessarily flying high because I'm doing well. And that also means I'm not necessarily flying terribly low just because I'm doing poorly. I can maintain a much more steady presence in the face of all of that compared to her, where I think that kind of stuff rocks her boat a lot more because she is more concerned about how everybody perceives her. And she wants to make that positive in things.
And that, Amy, I'm wondering if she has a four wing and if that contributes to the more of the emotional swings.
That just made like a really interesting connection for me as you guys were talking through that. I think what I realized is that as a type one, even as an EJ, there is a very like inner calibrative quality of type one-ism. Whereas for an EJ, you know, that stereotypically is more three-like, like you need that outward feedback to feel, you know, to get the pats on the back, you almost need that. But I've never really resonated with that. And I think that is that type one. I think there is that I'm sort of setting the right and wrong standards within myself. And so I don't need that, those pats on the back. I don't need those like good job isms that I think other types might need, because I know when I'm doing right and I know when I'm doing wrong, and I'm my own worst critic in a lot of ways. And so I'm harder on myself than anyone could ever be. So yeah, that was interesting to make that connection about that inner calibrative quality. I think that does come from the type one-ism.
Yeah, so gut types, particularly type one and type eight, they do have a strong sense of self and who they are. And they're not really inclined to change who they are. Sometimes they don't even know how to change who they are, in fact. Whereas the heart types, the 2, 3, and 4, they're very much people who need feedback from others in order to feel like they actually exist. Like daily feedback and daily affirmation of the type of image they're trying to put out to others. So there's a more changeable, mutable quality. So the 2s obviously trying to put out the image of a charitable, giving, loving person. The 3 is trying to put an image of efficient, successful, and doing. And the 4 is more authentic, unique, different, special. And they're all trying to get their image by different ways. With the head types, it's more assurance, reassurance, either from others or the self, that they can manage the chaos they experience in life and in themselves. So basically the type one is a type that can have a very strong, always has a strong sense of principles that they may change and modify when they get new information, but they're still fundamentally feel like they are who they are. Another difference is type A's and type ones are the types least likely to feel like they have a hero or they have an idol or anyone that they're particularly following. Like other types, like 3s, for example, very often have someone in their life or someone that they know that they feel, this person is successful, this person is efficient, I'm going to emulate this person, I'm going to dress like this person, talk like this person, go try and go to the same schools as this person if possible, things like that. Whereas type ones, it's more, yeah, that could be a useful guide, but they still feel like they know what the right thing to do is by themselves. They want to figure it out by themselves. And they're going with that sense of gut instinct. And that combination of gut instinct and reason that's refining the gut instinct in order to get the correct answer.
It almost feels like sometimes I have the fortitude to wade into the problem. Like, because I know where I am and I know what I'm doing, that it's like, I don't care that, you know, something bad is going to happen. I can even see it coming, but it, you know, winds may come, waves may crash. Doesn't matter. Doesn't, I mean, I may be sad about it. I mean, I can be not happy about it, but that doesn't going to change the necessarily the core principle in which I'm choosing to do something on.
Yeah. I will say that ones do consider the consequences of their actions and also other people's actions. So it's not that they're necessarily going to be completely bloody-minded about any principle, regardless mm-hmm. of that. But they're often when one does take action, it's because they're thinking, okay, if I don't take action, things will get worse, or this thing will happen, or likely happen. So there's kind of a tension inside the one between wanting to stick to your guns and wanting to do the pragmatic, effective, efficient thing. Like a sort of inner tension between your conscience and your pragmatism, and trying to find the balance of that is at the heart of a lot of type one dichotomies. I'd say, depending on like your Myers-Briggs type and your tri-type and your instincts and stuff, that can all play a part as well. But there's a common tension within ones.
Yeah, and so to help people who need sensory examples in the audience, what is a time in your life in which you had a battle between your conscience and pragmatism?
I wouldn't say there's any particular time. I'd say there's an ongoing thing that's happening daily. It's like always thinking about that. In my case, even if I'm not necessarily in a situation, I can always imagine like how someone should act in a particular situation. And I can be very aware of where people are choosing to be pragmatic or choosing to be principled, and when there's a right time and the right place for that. So that can happen with, like, if I'm seeing debates on the internet, or if I'm seeing things in the news, or if I'm seeing things in work or in the family life or anything. I do feel like I do have certain health issues, so that could be an example where I know what the right thing to do is, but I'm also conscious that if I do it, sometimes I don't have the energy for that, or I don't have the energy for what comes later, so I may force myself to hold off. But I'll always remember if I've done that, and I'll feel like I'm obligated to make up for it somewhere down the line. If I haven't done the right thing in this particular moment, I'll need to do the right thing later to make up for it. Or vice versa sometimes, but yeah, so it's hard to think of a concrete example, but it's just an ongoing dialogue with me in my mind that is just constant. It's like the background noise in my mind.
Yeah, it's always happening. It's never not happening. It's like your dominant function. It's the air that you swim in. Or no, it's the water that you swim in. You know, swim in air. Maybe I'm purposefully trying to make mistakes to see if your Enneagram 1 will want to correct me, to give like a real-time demonstration of you correcting me.
Well, I find that all the time with my kids and other people, where it's like, this is the standard I think things should be at. And do I want to bother insisting on the standard with you? Or am I just going to do an end around and get around you to get there? You know, like, is it, you know, yes, I can clean my kitchen and it looks great. Or is it more pragmatic to let my kids help me clean my kitchen, although it takes them three times as long as it would take me to do the same chore, but at least I got that third of a time back to go do something else, you know? And then how much of it, okay, now then I have to balance the point of, okay, so I let them clean the kitchen. Are they cleaning it as well as I clean it? Or am I going to ignore the fact that they're not doing as well, you know? And do I, or, you know, do I praise them for the fact that they got, you know, a good enough level done, although I'm not really happy with it, you know, like, you know, it's not the way I would have done it, but, you know, it's not my, I pull on that tension point a lot with different things of, and my oldest son is an intuitive, and my next two are sensors, and he would lose his head if it were not attached to his shoulders based on the number of times we have lost his glasses. and so it's like, you know, part of me goes, oh, well, he should develop this perfect method of keeping track of them. And part of me just knows, yeah, he's not like me. And he's not, this is just not. So how do we find the pragmatic solution to having glasses? Because glasses make, you know, allow him to function much better than not having glasses does, you know, so we have to.
Yeah, so I see that a lot of your one tendencies are channeled into your kids.
Well, like, it didn't just happen at with my kids. Like, I've been a teacher and I've worked at in places, and if I, like, my coworkers are not doing stuff up to standard, like, it comes out there too, unless, like, they happen to be a boss or somebody I consider the person I should be listening to.
Yeah, so no one is safe. I'm kidding. So Chuck and Samuel, you guys have been quiet for a while.
No, Joyce, you're right. No one is safe.
Yeah, I like that expression. My last job in the Coast Guard, I worked for an individual. He was my boss, a fairly senior officer. I think, and I don't know, but my guess would be ENFP, Enneagram 8. And I couldn't tell whether he was a narcissist or a Machiavellian. But certainly there was some psychopathology there, I think. And he was, I ran a summer program where we took 1,200 cadets and we sent them around all over the place doing all kinds of jobs. And it was, I had one individual that managed that function for me. And my boss was lying to the admiral, telling him things that weren't true. And if he got caught in the lie, it would end up making, you know, the whole program look bad. And so I learned what, you know, when they had that model of you can be conscious and you can be competent, and, you know, unconscious and incompetent, he was consciously incompetent. He used his ENFP ability to read people to manipulate them. And I was really disappointed with myself because I didn't go to the admiral and say, hey, my boss is lying to you. I ultimately made the pragmatic choice that it would be career suicide to do that, that even if the admiral, you know, wanted to have that information, you know, my career would be basically over with. So, it took using Robert Keegan's immunity to change model for me to work through that, to kind of get okay with not stepping forward and telling the admiral he's being lied to.
What about Robert Keegan's immunity to change model helps you get through that?
The first four steps call for you to kind of say, what are you unhappy with yourself about? And then what's the value that you hold that's underneath that? And then what's the competing value that's causing you to not change? So, staying employed and being able to feed my family and not being homeless was a kind of an invisible, thing that was holding me back from putting my boss on report.
Yeah, there's that Enneagram 1 desire to whistleblow if they notice something fishy happening, that's immoral that they see happening. But then they have to balance, am I going to do the right thing or am I going to get fired or some huge consequence? And I don't know which.
And I coached an ENTJ Enneagram 1. And forgive my vulgarity, but she called herself a shit magnet. And what she meant by that is she could go into any system and see what the flaws in it were. And then she, unfortunately, the reason I was coaching her is because she was calling it out to everybody and not making friends and influencing people. So,
well, I would say that for me, I don't remember any specific moment when I had to make like a conscious choices for like some contingency that I need to be more effective or just a principle. That's probably normal, but like I make the calculation because even when you're right, it doesn't mean that you're interfering in this situation will make things better, especially like in discussions on the internet. Like people who don't want to listen to you will not listen to you. So even if you believe that you're right and you're defending, it's worth defending. Sometimes just will not work, won't change anything, just like waste your energy. Of course, there will be a lot of time, a lot of circumstances that even with it is, there's no like fruitful consequence. The value is so strong that you must like fight for it nonetheless. Like in like normal terms or daily life, that probably doesn't happen. So I'm trying usually to make it, turn it real when it can become real, those principles and values.
Yeah, I've even noticed that pragmatism also shows up like in ways where it's not in conflict with my conscience, but it's something that really doesn't offend my conscience. And it's kind of a generic or neutral topic. Like when I was at work, I worked for McDonald's for many years, and they had standards that they had set of different things. And I could have sat there and argued with the standards, but I never did. I just said, okay, these are your standards. This is the way it rolls. And I would even turn around and enforce those standards on other people, which did drive some of my coworkers crazy, because to them, they didn't see the standard as important, as an important value to the company. They thought it would, you know, they disagreed with the standard for numbers of different reasons. And I would always look at them and go, doesn't matter. This was the company standard. This is what they asked you to do. If you want to be successful here, you need to do it according to the company standard, because they set it and they're the ones paying you. And, you know, if you want that pay raise or that job better or whatever, then you got to get with what the standard was. And so, but I noticed there were so many people who struggled with that, where I didn't struggle with that because they were the ones paying for me. And, you know, I was going to just follow whatever the standard was there.
Yeah, that's where the ESTJ and Enneagram 1 intersect, the introverted sensing, and also just the ESTJ-ness of enforcing the rules of the company. Jonathan and Diane, you guys haven't talked in a while, so I'm just poking.
I can step in here. So Jonathan started us off on this question, but I still don't have a super concrete example to give you, but I think I do have a concept that will make sense in an example kind of way. So as an Enneagram 1, I think ethics is like my default. It's something I'm always considering. And also as a type 1, high standards, probably impossible standards, are also my default. And so, like I said earlier, there's sort of an inner calibrative nature to that. And so I often am my own critic and maybe my own praiser as well, probably less often, but that makes it such that I don't always remember that other people do need praise. And so I struggle to actually give praise if people don't meet impossible standards. And so like, I can't give just meaningless praise. It's almost like I literally can't give it. I can't be like, good job, when it's like, it's not really a good job. You could do better. And I hate to just say that so openly, because I don't like that about myself. But, you know, for the purpose of illustration, I think that that's a very one thing. You know, you can't even live it up to your own standards. How's anyone else? And people do need praise, you know? And so finding a way to praise the things that were done well, to encourage people to continue to work towards my impossible standards, is probably pretty important to remember. And that's something that I do struggle with.
Yeah, I could see how for the one, it could seem fake to give someone praise when you don't mean it. Like, it could be better.
And even to receive it, like, I don't like to receive compliments, because inside I never do anything quite up to standard. So if I get complimented, I'm like, I don't know. It's a strange thing being a type one.
Why are you laughing, Jonathan?
I'm just thinking of conversations we've had about this very subject. Yeah. And by the way, Joyce, you're doing a fantastic job, and you're always fantastic, and we love you. You're very talented, and great working with you.
Yeah, and I would completely, after just saying that, I would completely second what Jonathan said. And that, knowing that you're getting a compliment from a type one, that should land pretty hard. Like, you do an amazing job, Joyce.
That's true. Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know if that's kind of sarcastic.
It's very real. It's sarcastic, slightly sarcastic, but it is real. I wouldn't say if it wasn't true.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
Oh, I'm feeling the love. Jonathan is laughing because I really like words of affirmation. I think it's a love language kind of thing too. I appreciate compliments. So even if you don't mean it, feel free to compliment me.
Well, when we say it, we do mean it. Just don't you know.
Yeah, I won't say it if I don't mean it. So if I'm quiet, just kidding, Joyce.
I mean, to be honest, if we're quiet, we've got some self-control going on.
Yeah.
If someone cooks you some horrible food, you're sitting there like, I'm going to say nothing.
Yeah, like ones are known for like, you know, a lot of mouth movements, like things like that. And that's like, I feel that's like, we want to say, we're kind of torn between wanting to say something, but also wanting to be appropriate. And it's like, the right thing to do is say something, but the right thing to do is also to be polite. And that's sort of manifests as just little facial expressions. Like, this is our version of telling the truth without saying things. It's like, yeah. But I will say, whenever I correct someone or say something, there's usually like 10 or 11 times where I didn't say anything. And it's kind of like, I'm giving myself permission, or it's built up so if I need to say something. Even if it was completely unrelated to, even if all those times were completely unrelated to what I'm saying right now, it's like I've had to just release the tension by saying, okay, this, I'm going to say something now. I've been polite enough to other people.
And yeah, we can be critical, but I think one of the things about ones is we're not critical of, because we're coming from a mean-spirited place. We're critical because the standards that we're used to are so high, and to be honest, we see the benefits of all these high standards in our lives that we really fundamentally do not understand why you do not want the benefits of these high standards in your life. And so we're going to give you criticism, but it's really criticism that we hope is useful to you so that you can have something better. Most of the time, that's what's happening there. You know, if the food wasn't great, you know, I may keep my mouth shut, but part of me is tempted just to say, hey, you needed more salt. You know, like, just because, did you not realize you needed more salt? Like, I did not realize until a couple of years ago that the secret to getting my kids to eat vegetables was more salt and butter, because that's not the way I grew up and not the way my mom made me eat my vegetables. So I have since made the change because somebody told me, in all honesty, the secret to getting my kids to eat vegetables was more salt and butter. And I was like, oh, okay, I will try this. And it worked. And so now, you know, so it would be very hard for me to sit there if somebody were, you know, wondering why this was happening to them and not say more salt and butter.
Yeah. Why settle for mediocrity when you could have standards?
And I think that's a difference. I know this is about Enneagram one, but we also have our Myers-Briggs type on here too. I think you're hearing a difference between Jonathan and I and what Amy's saying. When you have FE rather than TE, there's an appropriateness factor in there. And there is a bit of, you know, it's not extroverted thinking. I'm not going to give someone tips necessarily. Like, the solution works for me and the standards are mine. They're not necessarily everyone else's. That still creates some criticism inside, but I really struggle. I'm not compelled to tell someone. Like, that doesn't feel like my responsibility. So it's more of an internal struggle, if you will. Like, I'm seeing it, and I hope they're seeing it, and maybe my body language reflects it a little bit, but I don't view it as a gift to say, you know, these green beans need more salt and butter. Like, oh,
yeah. And for ESTJ, everything is so like concrete and objective in what I see that it just seems like it's like I'm not criticizing you per se. It's just like, this is a concrete thing and to me a simple fix. And I'm assuming you just didn't know any better, you know, like, as opposed to you were, you know, or if you did do it on purpose, I'm assuming it's because you're health conscious, not because you're trying to, you know, make something you don't think people would enjoy. And so that is a very much a difference between way they said, because like they say that they'll skip several times before they finally work up to saying things. I say things 9 out of 10 times, and the 10th time is when I shut up and don't say anything. And so one, you know, is all there, but there's definitely kind of like, it's all coming from the same place, but how it comes out, it definitely is reflective in our Myers-Briggs types.
Yeah, you're both socially extroverted and also cognitively extroverted too. So you're like double extroverted. And so you're gonna blah. Whereas I think some extroverts who are cognitively extroverted but socially ambiverted might be a little bit, like, keep it a little bit more to themselves. I know, like, with Chuck, he might be, even though he's not FP, he might hold back some of that criticism more often too. I could be wrong, but I'm wondering about your thoughts, Chuck.
Well, I like, when I think about, and this is a TNF thing, but the conversation is great for being able to connect and see where both models are always at play. I like the word critique better than criticize. Critiquing is, stating a gap between objective standard and reality. Criticizing puts that personalizing kind of piece in. And if we're going to use that, how many times out of 10, I think I'm like, 0 times out of 10 that I verbalize that kind of stuff. And that's because I'm a recovering perfectionist and I'm an INFP wannabe. As a younger person, I would happily share with you the gap that you had. And if I didn't like you, I wouldn't say anything to you. If I liked you, I assumed that you would want to know that you're not measuring up. And I'm going to give you the gift of calling out that gap so you can, do what I would want to do, which would be to get better, right? But now I know that, if I was going to do anything like that outside of my coaching work, I tell my coaching clients that I owe them frankness and communication. But I might say something like, well, how did you think that went? And then if the person says, well, I'd like to be better, I'd say, well, I've got some ideas. Would you like to hear them? So I'd always ask permission before I would kind of talk about what are some things that I'm seeing here.
Yeah, you're really channeling the inner INFP, like you said. And so, yeah. What does that space mean?
I'm always aware that I can always imagine that I'm good at something or that I'm doing well at something, and I could be fooling myself, so.
I wonder if that's the introverted intuition. It's shifting perspectives. It's like, well, that's my perspective that I've improved at this. If I were to shift perspectives, would that still be true? And so there's a little bit of that self-reflection, self-awareness there. And so Samuel, you haven't had a chance to check.
Well, I think that I'm probably close to what Amy said. Like, I usually see critique as an opportunity to free that person from being biased. Like, your perception is limited. When you have someone else's opinion, you can like consider new things and that can open up your judgment. So it's probably helpful. But actually I had a question to the panel because I usually relate to like being a type one with SI. Like, I want to have a good contemplation about problem, what I'm thinking about, but TE usually is the thing that tells me that the time is passing. Like, I have like timeline to meet, and I should like for once ignore the standards of being a type one. I probably believe that, especially for the extroverts, that for them is probably different. So I wanted to know, like, if they see there is a function that's more responsible for like their oneness, or there isn't, if there's a conflict. Something like that.
Yeah, and before you guys answer that, I'm wondering, Samuel, on a scale of 0 to 10, since everyone has kind of chimed in, do you withhold your criticism or do you tell people right away? How many times do you tell someone when you notice something wrong?
Well, that's a bit complicated. Like, that again, that depends a lot of the what I believe will be like the person will receive it, especially for family. Like, my mom cooked something like I didn't like. Let's say, mom, like I don't like this because I want you to know that I'm being truthful to you. So when it is good, I'll tell that it's good. But usually I try to limit to the level that the person is willing to accept. Like, people not always are willing to change or like see different perspectives. So if I had to criticize, like, you need to at least say some like good points they made in order for them to accept. Like, I really want it to be more like direct, but I don't think that's always like that efficient. So there's an element of calculation there.
Got it. One of the reasons why I also wanted to know your input was I know some ISTJs and their partners say, oh, he's an Enneagram 1 to me and his family, but he seems like a 9 to the people he works with. And so I was like, I wonder if that applies for Samuel.
Oh, that sort of makes sense. Like, especially because I have more time to build a better relationship with them than like coworkers. It's like, they have like some reason to listen to me as they are my family.
Yeah, and Chuck's like, I relate. I'm more strict to my family members than I am to random strangers. Oh, but Samuel, what was your question for everyone? Could you say that one more time? I didn't want to.
I saw a connection between my SI and being type 1 being stronger than TE. TE is usually the thing that opposes my 1 tendencies. I wanted to know, like, if NI, FE, or for AIM, that's like a different order, it changes a lot of SI, it breaks that oneness.
I would say that being a type 1 goes very well with extroverted judgment and introverted perceiving. So we've got the TE and FE and the SI and NI here. So I think it goes well with that combination of, like, I think the introverted percent perceiving. So NI or SI can go with, like, giving you ideas of how things should be, like seeing internally how things are supposed to be in the world. And then your FE and your TE kind of brings out the sort of judgment is the way you're going to, like, impose it in the world. So you could relate it to TI and FI as well, in a way, in the sense that FI has the values and TI has the principles. But do keep in mind that for a type 1, their values are primarily coming from a place of gut instinct, which is not quite TI or FI. It's more like the same place that 8 comes from, except that, like, type 1 is sometimes called the type 8 in chains, because they do have the same impulses as a type 8, but they're trying to restrain them and they're more managing their power. They don't want to go around. They're more considerate, shall we say, more aware of the consequences, and they're more trying to be a bit more refined and sophisticated in their own minds. So there's a slight difference there. And I'd say that extroverted sensing and extroverted intuition are probably the least one-ish impulses. Those are things that ones can, like, go into when they're, you know, exploring or trying to improve or change their attitudes, relax a bit more. But if you're leading with extroverted intuition or extroverted sensing, you'll probably have a hard time to You'll probably have a hard time truly relating to type 1, because you'll be much more interested in exploring and not really considering, like, the consequences of your actions and not restraining yourself so much. You'll be more about being open-minded, or seeing yourself as more open-minded or more opportunistic or whatever, whereas the ones are wanted to be, you know, structured and logical and principled in their life and in the world. So yeah, that's my thoughts on it.
My answer to that, I go to what Isabel Myers said, and that was, she said we should use judgment on ourselves and perception on others. And so my introverted intuition, I try to live in it as much as I possibly can, because extroverted thinking, I liken to a broadsword. You got to swing it hard and it cuts deep. So I always am thinking about others and use these models for, you know, why they are the way they are, and they don't need to be like me. And so I try not to practice be like me syndrome.
Yeah. And so when Chuck mentions be like me syndrome, it's a concept from Linda Behrens. She talks about be like me or be like them. We either think that other people should be more like us, like, why aren't they doing this like us, or thinking like us, or acting like us? But at the same time, we can also have BLT, which has a different meaning now. It's a sandwich, but it means in MBTI language, be like them, which is, you might feel pressure to also be like other people. So yeah, fun fact.
Well, I do notice as a one, when I've heard eights talk about how they just naturally respond to situations, and they can get really forceful and aggressive, and a lot of the descriptions we classically associate with eight and the way they feel angry about things. And I listen to those, I'm like, yeah, I totally feel all that. But the restraint part of it also comes in on the side of I can't let loose like that. It's very hard for me, because if you think an eight is destructive when they let loose and they decide something's important, when I let loose and don't constrain myself, it is scorched earth. Like, I will take out everything in my path if I don't have restraint. And it is extremely dangerous, and almost universally will I regret everything about what happened in that moment. And so I know that that's part of why I love the restraint of it, because yeah, done that a couple times in my life, really hated that experience. It usually comes back to really bite most of the time.
I do feel like there's a part of type ones that often thinks they're just a little bit better than type eights, so a little bit smug about it. Like, the eights sort of just, you know, not because they're not controlling themselves, they think they're such a badass, but if I really threw down, I would destroy them and completely. That's how I set with the hubris that I can have versus the type eight. I don't, the eight probably wouldn't necessarily see it that way. They still think that, I think with type eight mentality is that if that is true, that's because you're restraining yourself too much, that it's healthier to express yourself. And if you're restraining yourself, then of course you're going to have all these destructive impulses because it's been boiling up all the time. So the ace will think it's healthier to just let it go compared to the type one. And I think at the same time, there is that part of type one that doesn't want to let it go just because it makes you feel like a kind of a badass compared to a type eight. At least that's my inferior SE talking.
I think they also think that they could rise to the occasion whenever we let loose. Like, they're like, yeah, you're bad. And you might be worse than now, but I still can take it, you know, too. So
I gotta say, when I think of them, I agree that they think like that, but I would take that as kind of a challenge and an insult. I think there'd be some part of me that would want to, like, kind of like want to go far too far just to justify the fact that I've been restraining myself. It's almost like I would want to actually scorch the earth because I feel like I have to, but I would scorch the earth because I feel like I want to, just to prove that I was right to restrain myself in the very beginning. There's some part of me that feels that way. And it's not ever, I don't think it's something that would ever actually happen. But there's the hubris there, or the inferior SE, however you want to phrase it.
And Diane, I saw you on mute.
Just to add on to what you two are saying, I would say that as a type one, looking at the approach of a type eight, it's like, I mean, I could do that. I could release the dragon, but I'm more civilized than that. And there's maybe a time or a place. So there is almost that looking down your nose. It's like, and I have a little more access to SE than you, Jonathan. So you don't want to see that. Like, I got to keep that inside. But to go back and answer your question, Samuel, when you first asked it, the first thing that came to mind was actually TI as sort of the driving force for Enneagram oneness. But after listening to Jonathan, I think it's not as simple as that. I think Jonathan is onto something there. I think it actually is the NI in me that really provides the vision and the potential. So it really does provide a lot of potential assessment when it comes to myself, my own potential, other people's potential. And so I think it is coming from the NI. And then the should statements, of course, are coming from your judging function. So that's coming from a combination of, for me, both FE and TI, and probably more FE than I like to admit. You know, I'm an EJ, so I like to think I know myself, but I know I really don't. You know, a lot of who I am is, you know, one and the same with the group. So I think it really does. I think you're right, Jonathan. I think that resonates more, that tendency and those high standards come from NI and me.
Yeah, because like I tend to see that introverted functions, they look for, I forgot his name, but like, actually, it's not John Barnes, like someone like that. Like he told that like introversion is a tendency to unity. So like we're using an introverted function. You can't try to seek like completeness or wholeness more than an extroverted function, because like an extroverted function is know that things change, like you have to adapt to the circumstances. But like for me, as being like a dominant SI user, it'll just like be the perfect combination. Especially for the EJs, the contrary, like for them, like the tendency for multiplicity is is stronger. So it's a lot of, could be different. Like it's good to know, like there's probably like some key factor to introversion and restriction for the type one.
Samuel, do you find your SI is just so handy at tracking all those standards to know which ones are the best ones? Like sometimes I think my SI is also capable of going, okay, that one's so super unrealistic. Let's set the standard here. Even if I may try to keep myself to the unrealistic one, because I did that one time, I can try and do it again. but do you find that with SI?
Well, usually I have like the image or the understanding of the thing, the goal is usually something concrete. So like I have a knowledge about that. So all the standards, they are derived from that knowledge. So they're sort of natural. They're part of my understanding of what that thing is. So for me, it makes more sense to know all your standards, or at least most of them.
Is there any last question you would want to ask each other before we go, or does everyone feel complete?
I would just like to say it was so much fun. I wish we could go on for a few more hours.
Yeah, there could definitely be a part two and more. We'll see. We'll find a topic to center around next time to make it a little different. But yes, this is the Fantastic Five right here. So we can't let that go to waste.
Although I'd love for you to find a P that would join us for something like this, because it would, I imagine being a perceiver and a one would be just such a different feel.
I would imagine that if they're a P and a one, I would be thinking they're mistaped. So.
That is also true.
Yeah, I challenge you to find an EP who's truly a type one. I'd be surprised if they exist. Maybe an IP.
I find when perceivers think they're ones, it tends to be they have a strong religious background. But then afterwards, they end up changing their Enneagram type. So,
yeah, we actually, there's a person who's not here who we also interviewed for the book who was asking about the difference. They're an ITJ and they were asking about the differences between being a type one as a religious INTJ and religious people of other types. And it was so funny because they just described the differences between themselves and a bunch of people. They described how in their church, they were actually pulled aside by the pastor saying, look, I see how passionate you are and great, but you have to realize that people are not like, they're not as strict about roles as you. They're not as strict about getting things right as you. So when they were pulled aside by like, was it ENFP or ESFP or something like that? And they're so very different. So yeah, like religion kind of manifests differently in different types. So like, it's very common, for instance, for ENFPs to, you know, kind of treat, be in the market for a religion, almost like they'll go to different churches of different denominations just to try them out, just to see what it's like. And yeah, so there are qualitative differences between being a type one and being religious, or being a type one and having strong beliefs. Not all type ones will be religious either, I will say. But certainly most type ones will have a strong belief system about something. And that will be different from, it will manifest differently from simply having a strong belief system in general.
Excellent distinctions, Jonathan. And so thank you everyone for coming out today. It's nice to have an Enneagram master like Jonathan in our wakes to help describe the phenomenon as it's happening, and everyone gets to benefit from his knowledge. And yeah, thanks, Amy, for teaching me about the scorched earth. I will try not to piss off an Enneagram one. That is my lifetime goal. I'm kidding. It seems like you guys hold it back and you practice your strength a lot. So if someone's going to bring that out of you, then they really put an effort to bring that side out of you. So there is a Kraken in every Enneagram one, no matter how civilized they are. Yeah. And Diane, thank you for showing the FE side of the Enneagram one. And you and Jonathan care about appropriateness more so than the perhaps the thinking counterparts. Although anyone over time can care about wanting to be appropriate. So like thinking types may realize it's not effective to piss people off. So they'll be like, you know what? I'm going to try to create harmony because I don't get things done when people dislike me. So different types can arrive at the same conclusion. But yeah. All right, cool. And thank you, Chuck, for taking time out to chat with us. You're a little bit of a celebrity in the type space, so it's an honor that you carved out time to spend it with us this evening. And Samuel, thank you for your insightfulness, the unity and the multiplicity. Putting introverted and extroverted functions that way is very brilliant. So thank you, everyone, for watching. I hope you enjoyed this Enneagram 1 adventure into their minds, and that I hope y'all enjoy. So here, this is shedding light on, I have 2 in my Enneagram code, and so sometimes I flatter a little bit too much, but I try to mean it. I like when I give compliments, I really do try to tailor it towards the person. But yes, I am a little different than Jonathan in that regard.
The Fire OB tells us that we tend to reciprocate in kind with people. So if you would like lots of words of affirmation, modeling it outward is going to make it more likely that you're going to get your needs met. I'd like to appreciate you we wouldn't be in the room today if it wasn't for you. So thank you for bringing all this together and increasing the knowledge around all these kinds of things for everybody in the world.
Yeah. Chuck and his multiple models, helping the world with them. Yeah. All right. Thank you, everyone. See you all in the next one.